The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
So glad you're here tonight. I'm Miriam Spector, Vice Chair of the Foundation Board of Directors of the Library. I can't think of a better institution to support with all of my resources. Here, we transform lives and enrich the educational and cultural fabric of our great city of Philadelphia through our library's many programs, crucial services, and in-depth resources. Note that our guest this evening, Lester Brown, credits his hometown library at Stoke Creek School in New Jersey as a critical influence in his life's work. In developing an interdisciplinary and analytical framework for thinking about issues. Working with the School District of Philadelphia in this critical time for the school district and for the city has become a priority of this library. Our mission says it all. The Free Library carries out critical work each and every day to advance literacy, guide learning, and inspire curiosity in the greater Philadelphia region. If you value this library as much as I do, please consider making a gift of support through the foundation. To make a gift of whatever amount you can, please visit freelibrary.org/support. Easy enough. It is now my pleasure to introduce, according to the Washington Post, one of the world's most influential thinkers, Lester Brown. Mr. Brown, the founder in 1974 of World Watch Institute and founder and president in 2001 of the Earth Policy Institute, two nonprofit research organizations dedicated to analyzing environmental issues on a global basis and planning a sustainable future. His many honors include a MacArthur Fellowship, the United Nations Environmental Prize, and 26 honorary degrees. In 1986, the Library of Congress requested his personal papers, noting that his writings, quote, have already strongly affected thinking about problems of world population and resources, end quote. There is no living environmental analyst and writer as prolific as Lester Brown. He is the author of more than 50 books in 42 languages, which translates to 658 editions of his books. They include Full Planet, Empty Plates, and Plan B. His new memoir, Breaking New Ground, traces his life from a small farm New Jersey childhood to leadership as the founder of the global environmental movement. According to acclaimed scientist E.O. Wilson, Breaking New Ground is a much-needed testament and historical document for one of the great environmentalists of our time. Ladies and gentlemen, we're so pleased to welcome Lester Brown to our library.
Thank you, Miriam. The one thing you neglected to mention is that in 1949, I was Cumberland County, New Jersey junior tomato picking champion. Some of you will remember a woman named Liz Carpenter, who worked in the LBJ White House. She was Mrs. Johnson's social secretary. She wrote some of LBJ's better speeches. She was herself an outstanding speaker. And after the White House years, after the Johnson administration had ended, she wrote a book about her experiences. It was entitled Ruffles and Flourishes. It was on the bestseller list, and she was promoting it on a book tour. And one night in Atlanta, Georgia, by chance, she ran into her former White House colleague, Arthur Schlesinger. And he said he was sitting in the lobby of the hotel and she was going through and he sort of called out her name. He said, "Gee, Liz, that was a great book of yours. I really enjoyed it. Who wrote it for you?" She said, "Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it, Arthur. Who read it to you?" There was an article in the New York Times, this is some years ago, about the risk of being hit by a pickpocket in New York. And they told the story of a guy who was getting on the subway one morning, and as he was getting on, a guy at the last minute decided to get off and bumped into him, and he sort of instinctively remembered that pickpockets always kind of bump into you and get you, distract you while they're slipping your wallet. And he carried his wallet here and he reached for it and it wasn't there. So he took off after the guy and he caught him just before he got off the car. The guy was trying to get out. The doors are getting very close. He was trying to pull him back on so he would have him, you know, captured. And he pulled the sleeve of his jacket, tore off, and the door closed. So he was so frustrated because he was that close to getting him. And he was carrying this sleeve to the office. And he finally got there and he had to call his wife to sort of share his frustration with her. And she said, "Oh, hon, I'm so glad you called. You left your wallet on the kitchen table." I'd like to do a few sort of flashbacks tonight. I'm not going to do a chronicle of my autobiography or anything, but just pick out a few things that I think are sort of interesting and in some cases maybe amusing. When I was a youngster, 7, 8, 9 years old, I used to read the newspaper, the Philadelphia Inquirer, a neighbor down the road from us got, another farmer, and they realized when we came to stop by to see them that I would always retreat someplace and be reading the newspapers. So they decided to set aside the newspaper each day when they're finished with it, and the next day after school I could pick it up and read it. So I followed very closely the beginning of World War II, and particularly the war in North Africa. At that time, the Atlantic was controlled pretty much by German U-boats. They had literally hundreds of U-boats. And one of the early goals was to try to starve the Brits into surrender, into submission. They tried to cut off their food supply, ships moving with grain from the United States. So the response of the shipping industry was to organize fleets of ships to go out and have destroyer escorts and so forth go with them. Now, that didn't always protect them, but it made it more difficult for the Germans. They couldn't just pick off one unarmed ship after another. So this was a major sort of threat in the early stages of the war. And not only did the U-boats threaten transatlantic shipments, they also threatened the shipping of steel from Baltimore to the shipyard here in Philadelphia. When the war began, this was the shipyard. And so the ships would come down the Chesapeake and then the Potomac out the Atlantic, up the East Coast, in the Delaware Bay, and up the Delaware River. So the U-boats would just sit out there, literally, and they would watch the, during 1942, the Navy still hadn't figured out we should turn off all the offshore lights because those lights would show the silhouettes of the ships. So the submarines just sit out there, and it was almost like target practice in picking them off. I think in 1942, they sunk 82 ships on the East Coast, most of them between the Chesapeake and the Delaware. So that was of particular interest to me as a youngster. I mean, the ships, The ship sinkings were not reported for security reasons at that time. We've learned that since. But the we knew the attacks were occurring, and we knew that not all the steel that left Baltimore made it to Philadelphia. One of the things that my brother and I did early on in our was to start our own farming operation. When he was 14 and I was 17, we bought an old J.I. Case tractor, two-plow tractor, that had been traded into the local farm equipment dealer, and we got it for $200, and we got it running. We rented some land and grew that first year 28,000 tomato plants, which is about 7 acres of tomatoes. And it really, really came out quite well. Well enough that when we got the check from P.J. Ritter, the can house in Bridgeton, in November, we had enough money to make a down payment on a new tractor. And since my brother was very much involved in that, in the hard work in earning that, and I was already at Rutgers as a student when I was 17, so I decided he should be the one to go buy a new tractor. So he went, he's 14, he goes the local farm equipment dealer and starts talking with him about tractors and equipment and so forth and how much. And I mean, they couldn't quite figure out what this was all about. This was a kid, you know, who was talking as though he wanted to buy a tractor. And but they eventually realized he was serious. So he bought a new Ford two-plow tractor. And the arrangement then was you pay a third down the first year, $700, and a third down each of the next 2 years until it was paid off. So we had our first new tractor. Now, also during this first year, as we neared the end of the tomato season, I had to go to Rutgers for freshman orientation and so forth. So I decided that Carl, who was only 14 then and didn't have a driver's license, should get some experience in taking the tomatoes to the can house in Bridgeton, which was 10 miles away. So the idea was that he would drive the truck loaded with about 5 tons of tomatoes, basket stacked, in a pyramid sort of style with tied in from the sides. And he was going to take them to the can house in Bridgeton, and I was going to follow shortly afterwards just to make sure everything went all right. And as I was on the road between Rhodestown and Bridgeton, about midway, for those of you who know that road, and I saw a cluster of cars and so forth down the road. And when I got there, it turned out that Carl had to pass a farmer who had a couple harrows and something else he was drawing, disc harrows and other things he was pulling behind him. And Carl was going to pass him, but the guy was approaching his own driveway where he's going to his own farmhouse. So he moved out into the center of the road to make the turn, forcing Carl over on the side and so far over that while Carl got the truck back in the middle of the road, not all the tomatoes came back with him. So we had a situation where the tomatoes were about so deep, and the cars had made ruts through as you're driving through snow. You know, one car will go through, and then all the others use the same one. Well, that's what was happening with the tomatoes. So someone said, you need to call your field agent at P.J. Ritter in Bridgeton and you know, see what he thinks you should do in this situation. So he came out and got there very promptly. And he said, you know, most of the tomatoes here are actually in pretty good shape. I mean, a few are smashed and so forth, he said, but most of these tomatoes are usable. So he said, what I'd like you to do is to go over to the farmer who lives in the farmhouse here and borrow a couple of scoops from him. He said, get as many of the tomatoes back on as you can, but without sand and gravel and so forth. He said, park the truck behind the farmer's barn, see if he'll let you do that. And he said, tomorrow morning at 5:30, bring it into the can house and we'll unload it. I think they didn't want to deal with the PR consequences of these tomatoes, you know, being loaded back on the truck. And so they did that. And we actually didn't lose very much money on that particular truckload of tomatoes, and we had enough money to make a down payment on a new tractor. And then, over the next 7 years, from 1951 to 58, we kept expanding the tomato growing operation until by 1958 we had 280,000 tomato plants. So it was really getting to be a fairly sizable operation. But the great thing about it was the experience we got in, one, renting land, finding decent land and renting it, which is always a challenge because most of the land that's available for renting is not the best land in the township or the county. So it was finding land, it was renting it, it was signing the contracts with P.J. Ritter, and then we sort of outgrew them after a few years. So then we were taking our tomatoes to Campbell Soup in Camden. But the whole thing was just so educational, and organizing the recruiting and organizing tomato pickers to make sure you, because when tomatoes are ripe, they have to be picked pretty soon. They don't stay there forever. So you have to be organized in order to do that. So that was an interesting part of the backdrop. I mean, we were both going to school full time, and also farming. And one of the things you learn in those situations, I was also doing sports, wrestling, football, track, and so forth. You learn time management, and that was one of the sort of underlying benefits of trying to be a decent student, a scholarship student, and also doing sports and being able to develop a sizable farming operation. Our last year of farming, we were one of the larger tomato growers in the state of New Jersey. Now, by 1958, this was a couple years after I graduated from Rutgers, 3 years, I realized that I wanted to work in world agriculture. I had in 1956 spent half of that year living in villages in India and had developed an interest in village agriculture in developing countries. So I wanted to join the Foreign Agricultural Service of the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, but my undergraduate degree was in agricultural science at Rutgers, which was a great major. I was talking with someone earlier, but I think I had 24 science courses in 19 fields. I was like a kid in a candy shop with all these science courses. But at Maryland, you needed a degree in agriculture. I'm sorry, but to work in the Foreign Agricultural Service, you needed a degree in agricultural economics. So I enrolled at the University of Maryland in the fall of 1958, and in two semesters, I didn't have much money or much time, so I had to move fast. I did all the required coursework and wrote the dissertation, defended it, and on June 1st was ready to start working in the Department of Agriculture. I worked there from 1959 to 61, and then took academic leave to go to Harvard to get a master's in public administration or public policy, as it's sometimes called. It was then the Litauer School, now the Kennedy School. And when I came back to the department after completing that degree at Harvard, I was working in the Asia branch of the Foreign Agricultural Service. And Quentin West, who was the branch chief, said, you know, what we really need, Quentin was very progressive and ambitious, wanted to do things, wanted his branch to be the most forward-looking and progressive and accomplished branch among the regional branches, included Africa, Europe, Latin America, et cetera. So he called me in after I came back from Harvard and said, you know, we ought to do some projections for Asia, you know, for the countries in our region, long-term supply and demand projections. And I said, well, I think that's a good idea, but you can't really do a region by itself, because if you don't know what's happening in the rest of the world, you won't know for sure whether commodities will be flowing into your region or out of your region. And he said, well, we can't do that. We're the Asia branch. So a week went by, and he called me in again. He said, you know, we really ought to do these long-term projections for the Asia region. And I said, I think it's a good idea, but you can't do Asia by itself. You have to do the world. Well, he said, you know, we can't do that. So another week went by, and he called me in again, but he changed the question. He said, can you do supply and demand projections for the world? I said, yes. He said, how much time will it take you? This is June. I'd just gotten back from Harvard. He said, can you finish by the end of December? I said, I think so. So I went to work and produced the first long-term supply and demand projections. We published these in the fall, I think it was October of 1963. And I had met and talked with the U.S. News and World Report about the study. And they were interested in it, and they were going to cover it. They were going to do an article on these first global grain supply and demand projections to the end of the century. And they had the story ready to go in late November of 1963. And then John Kennedy was assassinated. So the issue in which this article was to appear was, I mean, they tore it up and they had to start all over again to produce a fresh article in light of this national tragedy. So I'd sort of given up on the idea that U.S. News and World Report would actually release this study or their article covering man, land, and food. But then my wife at the time, who was from a ranching family in southeastern Wyoming near the Colorado border, and I had gone out to visit her parents, who were ranchers there. She'd grown up on a ranch in that community, and we had our 3-year-old son with us. And we decided after a week over the holidays that I would come back as scheduled, but that she and our 3-year-old son would stay with the grandparents because they didn't get to see them very often. So we arranged for that. And they drove me to the airport on, I think it was a Sunday night, at the beginning of January. And on the newsstand was the January 6th issue of U.S. News and World Report with a cover story, Why Food to Be World's Number One Problem. And it was a 4-page summary of this study. It was an extraordinary bit of coverage for a U.S. Department of Agriculture report. But it was, in many ways, sort of a launching point for my career, in a sense. And the interesting thing was that since this study that I had done had never been on a plan of work and had never been budgeted, the people in the senior levels of the department didn't even know it existed until they read about it in U.S. News and World Report. And then the secretary, of course, was pleased that something in his department had gotten a cover story in a major weekly news magazine, but he had no idea who I was. I mean, no one. So he began asking questions. So when I got back from the ranch, I was invited to meet with the secretary. And he was both pleased, but also curious as to how someone that whose name he didn't even know in the department could have produced this study. So anyhow, that was the beginning of a relationship with Orville Freeman, who had been 3-term governor of Minnesota in the 50s. He was the one who put John Kennedy's name in nomination for the presidency in San Francisco at the Democratic National Convention in 1960. And it was the beginning of a friendship between the two of us that lasted until he died several years ago at age, I think it was 84. So this was sort of the early stage of my professional career. Now, there's one other thing that some people think also contributed to my sort of professional emergence. When the administrations changed between the Eisenhower administration and the Kennedy administration, our division was upgraded one whole level. So the branch chiefs who were GS-14s became GS-15s, assistant branch chiefs moved up, and so forth. But the bottom line was that up until then, only the branch chief could have carpeting in his office. But now the assistant branch chief could as well. So there are secretaries between them, so they would put in all new carpet for the branch chief, assistant branch chief. Now, since our branch chief had only recently gotten new carpet, I said to my roommates, my office mates, there were three of us sharing an office, you know, we ought to, at lunchtime, get that carpet and put it in our office. And one of the guys was from West Virginia, William Hall, and he said, oh, no, he said, I'm not having anything to do with that. I mean, he had a family, so he was worried about his job. And so he went down the library so he wouldn't in any way be associated with it. But our other office mate, Stuart Lerner, graduate of Cornell, thought this was kind of a neat idea. So we, at lunchtime, we drug this carpet down the hall into our office and then moved all the files to the desk and got it on the floor. And about 4:30, the guys who were installing the carpet came in. They were trying to find the missing piece of carpet, and someone said, why don't you try 4509? And so they wanted to take it out. We said, well, we're busy. We're working on a deadline right now. So for the next 2 weeks, between 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., either Stuart or I sat on that carpet, literally. I mean, we had a schedule. They couldn't move it while we were sitting on it. So anyhow, we eventually got the carpet, and that's how people discovered that we were important, and that's how my career sort of really took off. Let me go back to Rutgers for a minute and tell you what I think is one of the most interesting, sort of personal story, not involving me particularly. But one of the guys that I knew as a freshman, and we used to go for a walk after dinner, sometimes at night just to relax a bit before hitting the books. And we discovered that the two of us could pick up the rear end of a car. And if it wasn't too big, we could move it over and put one wheel on the curb. And I weighed 160 pounds. Tom weighed 185 pounds. He was powerful. So he got the curb assignment because you had to get the car up higher to get the wheel on the curb, and then we would just leave it there. It was kind of our idea of sort of surprising people, trying to figure out how in the world did I get the car on the... I don't remember. So anyhow, in January of our freshman year, Tom went out for crew. He had never been in a boat before, never done any rowing at all. But the coach at Rutgers, Chuck Logg, senior, had a son, Chuck Logg, junior, who was then a senior. Tom was a freshman. He decided to put Chuck Logg, junior, in, who was a very tall, lanky guy, 6'4", lean, and Tom in the boat together as a pair, so they could compete in the pairs competition. And Chuck Logg Jr.'s experience and Tom's power was just a great combination. And so they went to the National Olympic Trials that year, and they won. Then they went to Helsinki in July and won the gold medal in pairs rowing. But the interesting thing was that it was just 6 months from the first time Tom had stepped into a boat until he had a gold medal around his neck. I mean, I don't know if that's a record or not, but if it's not, it's certainly pretty close to it. I mean, a phenomenal sort of thing. Tom was just strong. I was not that surprised by their winning a gold medal because I knew how strong Tom was. I'm just doing a few topics here in random. I'm not trying to be comprehensive or systematic or whatever. Another question I was thinking about today that I might share with you was that some people aspire to be writers from the time they're quite young, you know, in school, and they just enjoy writing. They want to be writers. I never wanted to be a writer. I never aspired to be a writer. But what you discover is if you have ideas, particularly about global issues that you want to share with a worldwide readership, you have to write books, because that's the only piece of the information economy where there is systematic translation into other languages. And so I started writing books, and they were widely translated because I was dealing with global issues relevant to other countries. And recently had the delightful experience of publishing a book in Esperanto. How many of you know what Esperanto is? Esperanto is better known to my generation probably than younger generations, but it was a language that was intended to become the lingua franca for the world, the world language. But while they were developing it, and they developed it from scratch, they wanted it to be simple, they wanted it to be logically structured, easy to learn, and so forth. But while they were working on all these details, English just sort of took over. And the game was over sort of before it really, really, really started. And so we ended up with English today, which I'm grateful for, because if I had to learn another or other languages, I would be in some trouble. And if you want to reach a global audience, books are really the only way to do it. Magazines don't get translated. I mean, some magazines are translated in two or three languages, but they're not extensively translated. In thinking about the future, there's a lot to be depressed about. And I remember giving a talk in Arizona a number of years ago. And in the Q&A session, there was a woman who was sitting in the far back corner, and she said, "You know, you've been working on these issues for a long time. How do you avoid getting depressed? Because we don't seem to be making that much progress. You know, how do you deal with that?" And I thought for a bit, and then I said, "Bourbon." It works. Let me close my formal comments before, not very formal, but my comments before going to questions. Let me mention just a couple of signs of hope that I see in the environmental / climate area. And we talk about environmental problems. Climate is really the one that is huge. If we're not able to cut carbon emissions fast, we're probably not going to be able to avoid economically disruptive climate change. For example, we've inherited an agricultural system that has evolved over an 11,000-year period of rather remarkable climate stability. So that agricultural system is designed to maximize production with that climate system. But that climate system is no more. It is now changing. And so with each passing year, the agricultural system and the climate system are more and more out of sync with each other. And we don't know quite how to deal with that. And we're just on the edge of this, just beginning to see what it translates into. But let me just mention a couple of things I've come across fairly recently that are, I think, quite encouraging. One in the U.S., one in China. And these happen to be the world's two dominant economies and as a result of that, the leading energy consumers. In the United States, we have seen for the last three, I guess going on 4 years now, the Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign. Their goal is to close every coal-fired power plant in the United States. And a few weeks ago, they celebrated the 150th plant closing. Now, they still have 380 to go, but they're determined to keep going and to gradually phase out and replace all these coal plants with alternative sources of energy. It could be efficiency, could be wind power, could be solar, could be natural gas. Natural gas happens also to be a carbon-based fuel, not as intensive as coal, but it's not the direction we want to move in. So we are closing coal plants. At the same time, China has recently made a huge commitment to developing its wind resources. The Chinese have begun construction on 7 wind mega complexes that will each have at least 20,000 megawatts of generating capacity. 20,000 megawatts is like 20 nuclear plant complexes. It's huge. The largest of these 7 is in Inner Mongolia, where they're planning for 38,000 megawatts of generating capacity. That one wind mega complex will generate enough electricity to satisfy the needs of a country like Poland. I mean, we've not seen thinking in the energy sector on this scale before. It's huge, and it's exciting. So with those two encouraging things on the energy front, closing coal plants in the U.S. and building huge wind mega complexes in China, I will turn to the floor for questions. The program was called the International Farm Youth Exchange Program. It was administered, it was operated by the National 4-H Club Foundation, financial support from a number of foundations like Ford, for example, Rockefeller, and so forth. But the purpose of that program was to exchange young farmers from the U.S. with young farmers in other countries. So one, in my case, I was selected to go to India. So I spent roughly half a year living in villages in India with village families, being sort of part of the family. And it was one of those programs that evolved after World War II, in the effort to increase understanding among peoples, to reduce the chances of another world war, for example. It was not a technical assistance program per se. We were not sent as technicians. We were sent just as, not as missionaries either. We were going out just to learn about them and give them some understanding of who we were and what we were doing. It was, I think, without a question for me, one of those life-shaping experiences, because to go from this country to a village in India is about as far as you can go. These two societies were pretty far apart culturally and economically and so forth, so it was a great experience. But I had a lot of fun there, and one of the things that happened that sort of set the stage for some of this was that when we were in New Delhi, there were 10 young Americans, six guys and 4 gals who were recent ag college graduates going to India to live with families. But we had a week of orientation in New Delhi before we went out to the villages on, you know, what to expect and the various cultural nuances and behavior things you had to be aware of. And while we were in New Delhi, the Indian National Athletic Association was choosing their wrestling team to go to the Olympics in Melbourne in 1956. And so it turned out that 2 of us in the U.S. Contingent had wrestled in college, Ward Armstrong at Oregon State and I at Rutgers. So we got to talking with some of the Indian officials about U.S. collegiate wrestling. So they decided that we should give an exhibition of U.S. collegiate wrestling once they had selected their team. So literally, a group of wrestlers gathered around us. We traded clothes with the Indian wrestlers, and Ward and I gave an exhibition of U.S. Collegiate wrestling. Well, the newspapers the next day covered this. India, as you may know, has sort of national newspapers. Geographically, it's not large. You know, the Times of India, the Hindu, the Indian Express, and so forth, they're all national. And we just got extraordinary coverage. So the result of this was that wherever I went in India, when I went to a new village, the local wrestler would always be there to challenge me to a wrestling match. Well, it's great because, I mean, we wrestled on, what's the term for them, the pads we use in wrestling. They wrestle in dirt pits. And so that was a little different, but it was just great fun. And for reasons not altogether clear to me, the wrestling established a link between me and the villagers. I mean, the villagers got pretty excited about this, you know, in American and Indian wrestling. They were placing bets, and we became the social focus of the at least that week, if not the entire summer in India. So it really did establish links that you just can't achieve by sipping tea, which is what you usually end up doing. So that was a learning experience for me to see how something like that can affect the way people relate to each other. I've forgotten where I started, but I better end there.
Gentleman on our left here, and then we'll go here.
I'm glad you were able to give us some of the hopeful things that are happening environmentally now. But notwithstanding those hopeful things, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the global carbon levels continue to go up despite increasing wind power. You've written that it would take something like the mobilization that happened during World War II to really turn this around. But World War II was, you know, started for our involvement with this dramatic bombing of Pearl Harbor. And climate change probably isn't going to produce something, a single event of that magnitude. So how, and I guess in World War II, I'm not sure, I guess it was a presidential edict that said, we're not making any more cars, we're making war materials. How do you envision the kind, having said that it's technically possible to switch to wind power and solar power, how do you envision that political decision getting made?
Right. I've written some about the I think I have three models of social change. I don't know if I can remember all three of them at once, but one is where you have a catastrophic event that changes everything. That's the Pearl Harbor model. It was just one thing that literally overnight changed everything. Another is what I call the Berlin Wall model, where you have pressure building and building in a society, and finally it reaches the point where the wall goes down. That's what happened in East Germany. It just kept building, and when that time came, the leadership knew they could no longer suppress it. It was too strong, it was too pervasive, and the wall literally came down. So another model. Maybe a third model, I'm not sure I have three distinct models in mind, but one would be cigarette smoking in the United States, where for a couple decades in the latter part of the last century, we had a lot of education. We had efforts to restrict cigarette smoking. At first we put the smokers in the back of the plane, then we banned it all together, and we just kept sort of tightening the noose on smoking to reduce the amount of smoke that people inhaled, whether they were smoking or not. So that was one where we just kept gradually going, and we still haven't eliminated cigarette smoking, but the amount of smoking in this country is just way, way down from what it was, say, 20 or 30 years ago. One of the questions with climate change, for example, is we have various events, and we have people writing about it now, you know, who write about climate change and cite these storms, you know, or the recent typhoon in the Philippines, these kinds of events, which seem to be beyond what we have been accustomed to over time. And the number, they're coming with increasing frequency. We might have one severe storm in a year, you know, a decade or two ago. Now we have several in 1 year. So we don't have a single storm even though some have been pretty fierce. We haven't had a single storm that's changed things. That is the equivalent of Pearl Harbor. So it may be more a cumulative effect where, after a while, it used to be that people argued about cigarette smoking and the companies ran ads and testified before Congress, there's no proof. But suddenly we reached the point where everyone knew that there was a link, and it just sort of, the resistance constricting and banning cigarettes just sort of evaporated. So we may see that model here where the climate deniers just eventually we reach the point where no one will go out on the limb and say, oh, well, we really don't know, you know, if this is climate change or not. I think we're moving in that direction. And particularly since the scientific community is so, you know, in sync on this. I mean, 99% of the world's leading scientists. I think every National Academy of Science in the world, of which there are a substantial number, are in agreement on the climate issue.
We'll go to the gentleman on our right, and then all the way in back, there's a fellow in a green shirt.
Why the world ignore charity as a solution for so many problems that we have in the world? For example, in the 80s, we have big famine in Africa.
I don't know which famine you're referring to in Africa. We have not had a major famine in the world for several decades now. There clearly was one in China in 1959-61, when according to official numbers, 36 million people starved to death. And that was because Mao was so intent on industrializing overnight, and he encouraged farmers to build backyard steel furnaces so they could produce steel at the village level and overtake the United States in steel production and in industry generally. Well, it turned out that hundreds of thousands of these backyard steel furnaces were built, but there was never any steel produced from them. But there was a huge diversion of labor from the countryside that reduced the size of the harvest. And during that three-year period, the 37 million people starved to death that I mentioned earlier. So that was a huge famine, but it was a man-made famine. It was not caused by a disaster of any kind. I don't think there's been a major famine in the world since that. There have been severe hunger sometimes. Usually we've managed to get food in and avoid extensive starvation. That's not to say there haven't been a lot of people who have been hungry and malnourished during some of those periods. For example, I remember in India in 1965 when the monsoon failed. I mean, we knew it failed, and we were on top of that. And it took a fifth of the U.S. wheat crop to avoid famine in India, but we were able to do that. And I think we would do the same thing today if India or any other country was in serious trouble. One of the interesting things about that famine threat in India is that it looked as though, according to my estimate, that they were going to have to import about 12 million tons of grain. India had never before imported more than 4 million tons because that was their port capacity. So it was a huge challenge. And what happened in Washington was that we got some guys in the Department of Agriculture who worked in the Army Quartermaster Corps in World War II. So they were experts at moving, you know, something from A to B. That's what they were really good at. And one of the things they did to move more grain into India was they created an additional port by leasing the Manhattan, which was the largest supertanker afloat at that time, from Exxon, then Esso, and they anchored it in the Bay of Bengal. And on one side, the ships coming from the United States unloaded wheat on it, and on the other side, they unloaded the wheat on the dhows, the small boats that can go up the Ganges and the tributaries, and moved an enormous amount of grain into India and avoided famine totally. And that was a combination of the U.S. having the supply. We could just take a fifth of our wheat crop and ship it to one country to avoid famine, and also the logistical expertise to do that. In what was an unprecedented, there never been a food shipment between one country and another on that scale before, but we were able to pull it off. One of the things that we notice today is that we have organizations like Oxfam, for example, and various religious charities that become involved when famine threatens. And they often have a very good local food distribution capacity. So all governments need to do is sort of make the grain available, and they take care of the distribution. So we haven't had any major famines now in quite some time. And my hope is we can continue to avoid famines.
Yeah, in back in the green.
Yes, hello. I appreciate your levity and your jokes. They are very refreshing in this whole area that can tend to be a little gloomy. Do you have anything inspiring or helpful to say about the subject of genetically modified crops and the insidiousness that they seem to be taking over agriculture?
Yeah, what we have with genetic modification is a near monopoly by Monsanto. And when you have monopolies, you can get all sorts of problems. I myself have not done much research on genetic modification and the effects of consuming or feeding or consuming directly genetically modified crops. The unfortunate reality is there's been very little research by industry. You would expect USDA to be doing research on this to provide guidance, but there's almost nothing in the way of research. There was one article that was sort of in the news a month or two ago, and it turns out it was based on fraudulent research, and it wasn't intended even to measure the effect of genetic modification. So I personally do not have a good feel for what the effect of genetic modification is or will be on people or animals or what have you. But I do know that where that potential exists, we should have done the research before we sort of let this go. And that's where USDA, the U.S. government generally fell down. As you probably know, the Europeans, I think, have banned genetically modified crops there because of the uncertainty, not because they know they're harmful, but because they don't know. They haven't really been, this is a question that hasn't been researched, and it deserves to be.
Yeah, I see somebody with their hand up. I think it's a lady, yeah, right there.
Mr. Brown, given that there's been serious drought in the Midwest and Oklahoma, as well as Russia and places like that, do you ever see any political will growing to address some of the climate change issues as the red states start to suffer and their economies start to suffer and it hits people's pocketbooks in very different ways? Also the insurance industries as they start to deal with all the superstorm damages.
Drought is becoming more severe. In fact, almost all facets of the climate system are becoming more severe. And what is particularly disturbing today is that, well, let me back up a bit and say, when I was growing tomatoes back in the 50s, we'd have a heat wave or a drought or something one year. But we knew that next year, things would likely go back to normal. The problem today is there's no norm to go back to because the system is in the process of change. It's in flux. And that, I think, is poses a major challenge for farmers because we can't anticipate exactly how climate's going to change. I mean, we can make some generalizations about it, but we can't tell a farmer in Oklahoma or in Ohio, for example, how they should change their farming practices because, or even the crops they produce because of climate change. We're just way short of the knowledge we need because we have not researched the effects of climate change on all life forms on Earth, but including, importantly, the ones we depend on for our food supply.
And the last question, gentleman in the blue there.
Mr. Lester, hydrofracking in Pennsylvania, what do you foresee?
The question is, what's going to happen with hydrofracking in Pennsylvania?
I'm not sure what's going to happen in Pennsylvania. I think a lot of damage has already been done. My own sense is that fracking is not something we should be engaging in. It's extraordinarily disruptive, and we can't even begin to see the extent of the disruption now. We know that the fact that the oil companies or the gas companies that are doing the fracking don't want to release the names of the chemicals they use in the process. Because if they did, there would probably be a lot of opposition. My own sense is we're headed in the wrong direction on fracking. We have such an abundance of solar energy and of wind energy that we can harness without seriously disrupting natural systems. As an example, and this translates into a potentially positive situation. As the number of rooftop solar installations to generate electricity, solar cells, increases in a community, and they are increasing very fast now because the costs have come down to the point where it's become economic for homeowners to invest in solar cell installations. But what that then does is it shrinks the market for the utility. The more solar installations you have in a community, the smaller the market for the utility. So it has to raise prices because it's maintaining the same infrastructure. So it has to raise prices. So as the cost of solar cells comes down, the price of utility-generated electricity goes up. And suddenly, you have a positive feedback loop that becomes very strong. And what I think we're going to see is solar cells just begin to spread very fast and in huge numbers. It's already happening. I think the acceleration has just begun. It's going to keep going, and we will be getting much of our electricity from solar cells in the future.
I wish we could.
For economic reasons.
I wish we could go on, but we can't. Please join me in thanking Lester Brown. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.